Hi, I'm here with Patricia Olenek. I'm Carissa Terranova, professor of aesthetic studies at UT Dallas, and I'm interviewing Patricia Olenek, who's so graciously come to Dallas to talk to us about her work. She is the director of the School of Art at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and she's here. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So first of all, I just wanted to talk about your art practice and the role of art and science in your current practice as an artist.
Sure. As you know, I work with art, science, technology-related themes in my work, and that each project addresses typically a different theme or a different topic within that sort of triad. So two projects that I have ongoing right now are Dark Skies and also the Mutable Archive Project. They're both very, very different in terms of their focus and their scope. Dark Skies is a multimedia immersive wall that really starts with my interest in this idea that there is a biological and a psychological need for darkness. And it's not something I think that we really think about unless we've got, you know, nocturnal creatures that we cohabitate with. But it's certainly evident that light pollution causes multiple problems for both humans and non-humans alike. And so I began to look at cities that I was visiting, cities like New York, where there was so much sky glare that, you know, the sky was completely obliterated, and remembering growing up in Canada and seeing, not infrequently, the aurora borealis, and sort of thinking about how deeply those experiences impacted my sort of sense of myself as a being in a dimensional universe, and sort of what I'm missing when I'm in a situation where there's excessive light pollution or night glare. And so I'm really interested in sort of how these experiences shape us and shape human consciousness. And so Dark Skies began with me thinking about these issues, and also thinking about scale, thinking about biology and scale, and about how there are patterns of repetition across scale, or the repetition of patterns, perhaps I said that backwards, repetition of pattern across scale. So with a Dark Skies piece, I took a histological sample of a wild mouse taste bud. A wild mouse is one of the creatures that comes out at night. And I worked with a sound designer, Christopher Ottinger, and a designer and architect, Sung-ho Kim, to build a dimensional wall based loosely on the surface of a wild mouse taste bud. And the wonderful thing is, when you step back from this CNC routed wall, you really aren't sure if you're looking at an enlargement of a small form or whether you're looking at, for example, a topographical terrain.
And how what's the scale of that wall?
The scale of the wall is 8 by 8 feet, and it includes a two-channel video. And what you see, and each of those two videos is hitting the wall at a raking angle from either side of the piece. So what you see from the left-hand video is you see a kind of crepuscular sky, and you see a very dramatic sun going down over and over and over again. So you see the sunset happening over and over and over again in this piece. And on the right side, you see a night sky with kind of Milky Wave patterns. So when the two are projected simultaneously, there's a kind of lenticular effect in terms of the way that you
great.
See these two skies.
So the walls are, it's a walls facing one another?
Well, actually, it's one single 8 foot panel, 8 by 8 foot panel, but it's the two channels of video, the two channel videos, one, each placed at very, very sharp angles on either side of the piece. So there's a real lenticular effect. And I produced the sound component of the work at a residency during the I think it was the art science thematic residency at the Banff Center for the Arts. And I recorded creatures coming out at night. And former MFA student of mine, Christopher Ottinger, did the kind of post-production on the sound. So there are two speakers where you hear these night sounds, but the finished produced soundscape amplifies the small sounds and turns them into these kind of low rumbles. And then the high-pitched sounds get slowed down, and the the high-pitched sounds get slowed down, the low-pitched sounds get heightened. So you're really fluctuating between scales and between worlds. And so it's meant to be deliberately sort of immersive and dramatic and almost cinematic in its affect. And when the viewer interrupts one or the other video, the viewer is then implicated into the piece. The viewer then becomes sort of drawn into this interspecies environment where the human no longer has agency potentially, and where, you know, there's the possibility of all that comes with being part of an interspecies world and not having agency, such as, you know, the threat of contagion, for example. So it really is a piece that I think really does draw the viewer in a significant way. And I'm looking to build out the next phase of this piece so it truly is an immersive environment. I mean, thinking about Yayoi Kusama's Infinity Rooms.
That you just saw. That
I just saw.
That's great. At the Dallas Museum of Art.
Exactly. And thinking about ways that this can actually turn into a fully dimensional space.
Oh, that would be a great idea, like a room almost.
Like a room, yeah.
Right, so let's talk about archive and mutable archive, because it makes also a great segue into the medical humanities. But first, let's hear about that project, which comes before the Dark Skies project, right?
They're
simultaneous?
They're simultaneous, and I do tend to build archives over time and sit on them for quite a time before I really know what to do with them. So at least 10 years ago, I was a Francis C. Wood Fellow at the College of Physicians and the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. And I was working with a variety of collections. I was working with prosthetic devices, gynecological instruments, and I was particularly interested in one physiognomy collection. It was the collection of a Viennese anatomist and physiognomist, Dr. Hertel. And there are close to 150 skulls in that collection. There were 19 of them that interested me in particular, and they were gathered all over Europe. Probably most of them were acquired without, you know, the authorized, permission of the person. I mean, unfortunately, I think it was, there were the remains of people who were lost to the world in some way and who were criminals. And because Dr. Hertel was interested in finding a relationship between personality and the micro and macro features of the face, whoever had either unusual physical features or who had been executed for a particular crime, then he would gather these skulls. And if there were, for example, 10 or 20 people who had been executed for murdering their child, then he would look for similarities between, you know, he would be looking for sort of the biological source of that kind of behavior. So all of these skulls had postmortem skull tattoos in them and accompanying archive cards. Mm. So
from the 19th century?
From the 19th century, yes. And so most of them European, some of them Japanese, Siamese, I think one skull from Africa. And the accompanying archive cards were sort of provided very scarce information about the subjects. And over time, archivists began to write in their own notes. So if the original inscription on the archive card said that, for example, the skull belonged to a Dutch suicide, then an archivist 20, 30, 40 years later might write in pencil, how is it that we know this, right? So it sort of led me to think, well, boy, how much of this knowledge was actually just tacit or stated at the time but not recorded, and what is it that we actually know about these people? So the project exists as both a series of 19 photographs with the accompanying archive cards, but also as a series of performance videos. I'm commissioning writers each to write their own speculative biography for each of the subjects. So each writer will choose one subject, write a script for it, and then perform the script, for the ones that haven't done it yet, will be, but for the ones that have, you know, that we video recorded or audio recorded them. And then the final performance videos I'm working on with, again, I'm proud to say, another former student, Adam Hogan, a really brilliant cinematographer, and so we have gotten through.
You're making some videos.
We're making
sound and video.
Performance videos.
Oh, it's really great, because I've seen one. Buzz Spector, right?
Buzz Spector is one of the writers. Chelsea Knight, a New York-based video artist, really produced a really brilliant performance video. Victoria Vesna.
Wonderful.
Mariam Ghani.
Yeah.
Shimon Atti. So mm-hmm. we've got some terrific people mm-hmm. participating in this project. So I'm not sure that I'll get all the way to 19, but certainly when 7 are completed, I think I'll be ready to show them as a series. Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. So in many ways,
and Ellen K. Levy as well.
Oh, Ellen. Yeah. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yay for Ellen, mm-hmm. with whom I collaborate as well. But so what I want to use this second body of work to lead into is your work and my work and the work of the medical humanities, which is a burgeoning field in the academy. We have it burgeoning at our own university here at UT Dallas. Mm-hmm. And I know at Washington University, you're co-teaching a class. So let's define the mm-hmm. medical humanities. Earlier today, you gave a great definition of it, I thought, with respect to the centrality of empathy and bringing together art and pre-med students.
Absolutely.
And medical students.
And this is really, you're absolutely right. This is a burgeoning field, and I've been reading numerous articles recently about why so many universities are now requiring medical students to take medical humanities courses. I was invited to jump up onto this project by a coworker, a colleague of mine, a cultural historian, Professor Rebecca Messbarger, who wrote the first biography of the first woman anatomist, Anna Morandi. And so we have a provost interdisciplinary grant to teach a course of 60 students, predominantly pre-med. And it's really curious that statistics say that the average medical student who goes through the course of their training comes into medical school having a very, very high level of empathy, and that each student actually finds that their empathy drops significantly by the time they graduate or by the time they're specializing. Mm. This is a really interesting statistic, especially when you compare it to data that indicates that empathy is critical to positive clinical outcomes. So what we can deduce
from the healing of the patient.
So what we can deduce from this is that contemporary medical training to have a practice is antithetical to positive results and to healing. So we really, you know, in this course, my role is to show how various artworks enhance empathy, but also extend and expand conversations about contemporary medical practice. So we will look at historical examples. We'll look at, for example, a body being dissected from, for example, Rembrandt's painting of Talp. The anatomy lesson. And you'll see that there's a shadow over the face of the patient. And then you compare that to the Visible Human Project, where we know Jernigan's story. We know that he was an executed criminal. We know so much about him. And when we see the body, we recognize him as an individual human being. So just even the way that the dissected body is portrayed so differently today, I'm showing examples of artworks that indicate a period in time when the medical profession shifted its attention from looking at the AIDS pandemic as simply contagion to looking at it through the lens of personal human loss, through the works of David Wojnarowicz and Hanna Vilke, for examples. You know, really very courageous documentation of her own body and going through,
it's interesting.
Cancer training. So it shifts to the medical students then look at these images and they say, wow, it's not, you know, art is not just about aesthetics. It's about what these artworks do.
Living bodies.
These artworks completely change the way that we think about content in medicine.
Well, I find it fascinating that you're through the medical humanities in this course that you're teasing out the living body, which for us in some of our dialogue, my practice is biological in nature, but through conceptual art.
Right.
So that's an interesting thing. So how do we understand the medical humanities with respect to contemporary art? I mean, do you have any ideas about that or comments?
Well, I mean, I think that the focus in the class is to get the students to think about, there are always assumptions that we have about one another's disciplines and occupations. And I think that there's such a strong focus on the aesthetic components of things. The aesthetics are certainly very, very important. But when we think about the kind of space that a lot of these artworks, particularly over the last 30, 40 years, occupy, and this is what I'm really focusing on, and you think about, for example, Damien Hirst and the way that he's, you know, I think Nevermind the Bollocks piece, where he's mixing street drugs with, you know, opioids and prescription drugs, when the students actually see those medicine cabinets, it changes the way they start to think about and talk about the way that we would value one and the way that we would...
One's illegal,
one's not illegal.
Yeah, the illegal one is what's killing rural Americans.
And yet there's so much disdain. Otherwise. There's so much disdain for the street drugs, and yet in a way when you really start to assess the harm.
Yeah.
So the way that artists are actually bringing together it creates a certain kind of, as you say, like a kind of reconceptualization.
It reframes our, like, because we both are practicing with one foot in the science, technology, and one foot in art. And, and so together, when we bring them together, like in the medical humanities, it reframes both fields,
which is fascinating. It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Yeah, I think the students are quite transformed by the class.
And so one of the other things that goes on, I think, through the medical humanities on maybe the edge of it is rethinking individuality, the human as kind of chimeric and other, which leads me into your current, one of your most recent forays is to the Frankenstein Project. Would you want to talk about that?
Frankenstein has always been a big, I can't say supporter of mine. We weren't from the same era, but a great inspiration to me. And so this is the Frankenstein. He's a muse. And so Frankenstein is the... key cautionary tale where the monster lives both in external form and also in an internal form, because we're looking at Dr. Frankenstein and wondering whether or not the monster really truly lives within. But the Frankenstein 200 symposia are happening all over the United States right now, and I'm sure that
and they just had one at Washington University, right?
Just had one at Washington University, and I did a presentation on the topic of redesigning humans and how genetics, transgenics,
pharmaceuticals, synthetic biology.
Absolutely, all of these are kind of reframing the way that we think about human life. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the case of even looking at the artist Stellar, can his belief that the body will soon become obsolete, that technology will supersede what the human body can do, and that we will in fact almost begin to live in another physical form through technology. So it's more than simply the imagination of the body, the reimagination of the body by way of technology. It's actually the reshaping of the body and the reformulation of new neural networks through the kinds of works that he's doing. And of course, there are so many other stories. I'm thinking about Avital Ronell and, you know, something that she mentioned, I'm trying to think of the book that...
I don't know her new book about that's kind of chimerically oriented or Frankenstein-oriented.
Right, and I think it's called The Telephone. It might be
the Telephone book is about 20... It's 25, it's 25 years old or so.
Yeah, and in that book, she's talking about Alan Turing, and she posits that it was Turing's loss of a friend in childhood that might have spiked his imagination to build the first computer, because she believes it could be the case that he was thinking about how to save or preserve the life of his deceased childhood friend in a new physical form, even if that physical form isn't human, right? So this idea of hybrid life exists sort of through Gothic literature.
Yeah, the fascinating thing is that Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's book, is 200 years old, yet it has so much resonance in the 21st century.
Right.
So that's a testament to the living quality of her work of art.
Absolutely.
And it's a morphogenesis or transformation over time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that the idea of hybridity, chimeric life and hybridity, even goes beyond the biological. We start to think about the social. We start to think about
that's
the kinds
great.
Of border relations,
genders.
The kind of sociology, P. Orridge, and of course, is one of the artists who was doing the Pandrogyne project, where he and his wife were both getting surgeries to look more and more like one another. And then after she passed, he's continuing to have the surgeries, which refashion him, continue to, through the process of bioelective enhancement, he's looking more and more like his deceased wife now. So it's really curious. The kinds of projects people are taking on with themselves as both subject and object.
Right, in the spirit of scientists to use their own bodies to test upon. guinea pigs, which is that's a wonderful, like Marina Abramović meets Haldane, the scientist from the biologist from the mid 20th century.
Exactly.
But I think that we are out of time because we just saw Roger Molina. Although I do have one last thing. Mm-hmm. One of the things I know you're dedicated to, as am I, I'm fascinated by and the history of it, the popularization of the knowledge that you're creating and the role that the Leonardo meetings play up in New York City that you're co-hosting with Ellen K. Levy. Could you talk a little bit about that and then we'll conclude?
Absolutely. Well, the laser meetings are happening all over the world. They were initiated by Piero Scaruffi in San Francisco approximately 10 years ago. And Victoria Vesna, Ellen Levy, and I... Victoria and Ellen began the New York Lasers, which are a series of art, science, technology salons that also include humanists and curators and arts writers. We meet in New York City approximately every 6 weeks. Victoria and Ellen sort of started to talk about a very early form of the current form of the New York Lasers, and since 2008, Ellen and I have been hosting them in her studio, Levy Arts, in New York City.
Right, which I have frequented.
Absolutely. And they are terrific. We have an incredible...
And they're open and inviting and welcoming.
Exactly. And we very deliberately do not record because people are using those forums as a kind of testing ground for their ideas. So it is a really, really rich exchange of ideas.
I think so.
I'm thrilled to see.
History making. Even though we're not recording them, they are history making.
They are history making, indeed. Yeah. We have to have good memories.
Definitely. Well, so thank you so much, Patricia Olenek, for coming to UT Dallas, to Richardson, to the ATEC building and the ATEC program to share your ideas with us.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.